You know, I don't know how else to say it, but you got to engage in this discussion about what it means to relinquish the illusion of power.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service. Indigenous environmentalist, land rights activist, and former candidate for Vice President of the United States, Winona LaDuke, delivered the keynote address at the Mario Savio Free Speech Award in Berkeley, California, December 4, 1998. She was introduced by one of the heroines of the free speech movement of the 1960s, Bettina Apfecker.
She is a national treasure. She has won many awards, been revered and distinguished in many, many ways. She is of the Anishinaabe people, whom we know often as Ojibwa. She has been an environmental activist, one of those who have most courageously and for many years organized in honor of the earth. She founded the White Earth Land Recovery Project and the Indigenous Women's Network. She has master's degrees from Harvard, which has been extremely instrumental and helpful to her, I think, in her struggles for the reclamation of lands stolen from her people. I just finished reading her novel, which is called Last Standing Woman. It is a wonderful, wonderful book. I highly commend it to you. Writer Louise Erdrich said, "This book goes out into the world much as a prayer. Reading it, I am blessed by the writer's use of language and strengthened by her courageous vision." What I found in reading the book was the almost unbearable pain and suffering of the genocide committed against indigenous peoples, which is told in relentless and careful detail, and then feeling the resilience and struggles of new generations to reclaim land, reclaim culture, honor earth, and actually try to save all of us with a generosity of spirit and a hopefulness and courage that staggers the human imagination. Winona LaDuke has been central to that movement. I consider it a great honor to have the privilege to introduce her to you this evening. Thank you.
Thank you. It was a very kind and generous introduction. I always feel a little bit, it's a little big. But thank you. It was very kind. You know, I was honored when I was asked to come and give this lecture tonight, because I was very much influenced by the courage of the people of this community and by many of you who are here. You know, so long ago when you stood up for people's rights, I was raised by very good parents who always said, do the right thing. One of the most telling things of my childhood was every night watching Walter Cronkite on the news and the body counts. Remember this? The body counts, you know? And I can never get that image out of my head. The body counts every night, you know? And I know that that influenced very much how I think and why I do what I do. So it is, very much an honor to be here in that same spirit of those people who engaged in that struggle. You know, it's also a big honor to be asked to give this lecture, you know, in free speech. My brother Jason is in the back of the room, and he knows that my entire childhood was characterized by my struggle for free speech without being sent to my room. This is my night. I don't get sent to my room when I say whatever I want to say, right? No. So when asked to talk tonight, I thought about what is important in my community to express and to perhaps give you some idea of what the things are that we work on, what I do in my work. Maybe that will inspire some of you. Maybe that will make some of you who have been struggling for a long time feel good. You know, to know that some of us way far away work on these things, we think of these things that are similar, and why we do them. You know, I find that my work is motivated by several factors. In the teachings of my community, the Anishinaabe community, and other indigenous communities, we are taught that we as women are the mothers of our nations. We are the mothers of our nations. And as such, all issues of our nations are women's issues. They are of concern to us as women. And so that forms very much my thinking. Everything is my business, you know? Everything is my business. Which at times makes my partner a little bit uncomfortable, but that's how I believe, you know? And also as a mother, you know, I have two children. They're not so small now. I have an 8-year-old and a 10-year-old. But as a mother, I find I cannot understand why I should be more concerned about how much sugar is in my son's breakfast cereal than I am how much PCBs is in my son's tissue. You know, that is the reality in this day and age. To be a mother, to be a parent, responsible parenting seems to involve actually having to be concerned about these issues like that, you know? And it seems that you have to weigh them in that significance. I'm also, my work is also formed by the recognition of that we are a part of a much larger. You know, a lot of the old teachings of Indian people talk about the intricacy of the web. You know, how we are all part of one web, and that, you know, it is all the web of life. It's what, you know, what they used to say. And we know that. You know, we all know that now, although it took all your sciences a long time to figure that out. You know, but that is reality. You cannot change one thing without changing many other things, you know. But that is the same in political work, that ripple in the pond. So you could do something small here in your one community, but it gives someone an idea someplace else that maybe they could make a difference too. You know, they see that. That those people over there, well, they stood up. Those people over there, they did that thing. That's good. You know, it gives them courage in their heart. Gives them courage in their hearts to know what to do, you know, or to get an idea that they too could do that. That affects very much our work, but I also recognize that that ripple comes the other way. And someone someplace else makes a change, or something happens, or there is a bad law which is written, it affects us too. And so I always have to keep my eye on this bigger picture, I find, you know. So I work in my own community, and then, you know, I work nationally with a lot of these grassroots groups around these issues. You live in these Indian communities, or you live in these communities, and you find that you are engaged in this intergenerational relationship of predator and prey. You know, we are landed people, and that which we have is that what somebody else wants. That is the reality of our situation. And you wake up every day, and that relationship has not changed. It is the same relationship. And so every day you must consider what it is today that they would like, and how you are going to not give it to them. You know, that's pretty much our job. You know, so it's kind of simple. I'm always thankful that the Creator gave us rather simple. I don't have to struggle too much with a lot of big things, but every day I have to say, oh, I hope I can do it. You know, that's what you got to struggle with. But I'm thankful that, you know, you're given that kind of clarity. On my reservation, the organization I work with, called the White Earth Land Recovery Project, work on three major issues: land, culture, and environment. Work on land, the land issue, because if you do not control your land, you do not control your destiny. That is the reality. Especially as indigenous people, we are land-based cultures. That means that our people tell those stories about when the giant fell asleep by the lake and slumbered there. And that is why that mountain is there today. Our people tell the stories of, you know, why our houses are constructed traditionally in the formation of star constellations. Those are cultures that are based on this resonance between these things. And so you must have that land on which to live. It is not an abstract idea, you know? It is not an intellectual thought. It is not something that can be replaced. So you have to always struggle to keep that which you have. My reservation is not unlike many other Indian communities in this country. You know, very little land is left in many of our reservations. My reservation today, 90% of the land is held by non-Indian interests. 90% of my reservation land held by non-Indian interests. Why is that? You know, the relationship is between wealth and poverty. Our wealth has become our poverty. The greatness of our land, 47 lakes, you know, forests, great pine forests. The beauty of our land coveted by others. A foundation of fortunes like the Weyerhaeuser fortune. Heard that name? Weyerhaeuser. You know, start on my reservation, Weyerhaeuser did. Move west. Done pretty well for themselves, huh? You know, but their wealth is my poverty. So our community, vast majority of our people are landless. 3/4 of all tribal members do not live on the reservation. Refugees in our own land. Every social and economic problem you can have, we have it. You know, the statistic, if you want to be at the bottom or the top, wherever you don't want to be is where we are. You know, whether it's unemployment, 65%, arrest rates 7 times that of non-Indians, whether it's diabetes rates, 40%, you know, everything you don't want, we got in our community. Why is that? You know, white people in my area, not to diss white people, but, you know, in our area, a lot of some non-Indian people, they say, well, you know, you Indians, you know, if you go get yourself a job, you'll feel better. You know, I don't know. I know you're all out here. You're very intelligent people. Well, we hope. In my area, you know, people do not care for Indian people so much, you know, non-Indian people. You know, you ask me to come talk to you out here, and I'm fortunate that non-Indian people ask me to talk to them out there sometimes, but sometimes it makes their ears hurt. You know, make your ears hurt maybe a little bit too. You know, but I was asked to talk to the Rotary Club. And this border town to my reservation, border town, that means town that was built on my reservation. You know, amassing the wealth, whether it was the logs, whether it was whatever it was, you know. I go talk to those people and they say, you know, this room entirely full of men. And they said, I said a lot of things. They said, I knew an Indian once. I always like that phrase. I knew an Indian once. You know, you want to say, I bet you did. You know, I knew a white guy once too. Yeah, you know. You know, this is how prejudice is repeated though. You understand what I'm saying. You know, they come up with these things. You know, I knew an Indian once. He did not have a job, did not want to work. Well, there you go. I knew several white people like that as well. But they say these things, you know, they say, if you Indians would go out, get yourself jobs, you'd feel a lot better. You know, and I said to these guys, I says, the problem is you are telling us to go out and get our bootstraps, pull them up, get our boots on, and we'll feel better. I says, the problem is that you have our boots. You know, that's the reality. That is what is structural poverty, when 90% of your land is held by someone else, you know. So we struggle to get back our land where, you know, people who went all the way through the courts, I am someone who tried the justice system, and I have come to terms with the fact that they call it the just us system for a set of reasons, you know. I'm someone who went all the way through the courts to try to get my land back. The courts, you know, originally ruled that our land was taken illegally because it was. You cannot thumbprint a deed when you are a 13-year-old. You know, that's illegal under the law. Cannot tax forfeit Indian land. That is illegal under the law. Blind women, you know, how our land was taken, illegal takings of our reservation. Courts originally say, well, that's illegal. So we go to court to get back our land. Then the court says, the statute of limitations has expired. Should have filed suit within 7 years of the original time of taking. Having not done so, you are out of luck, you know? So I tell you that story because I'm not a, because I call that legal realism. I'm not someone who believes that the system works like that. I tried. I went all the way through the court system and, you know, the courts basically slapped me in the face along with all the other Indian people on White Earth Reservation. Said, you know, we feel bad. And so we look around and we say, well, you know, we do not have our land. The courts say, well, it's too bad you people don't have your land, but we aren't going to give it back to you. You know, that's kind of a summation of the court decision. So what do you do if you're me in that situation? Do you say, well, tough. You know, that's too bad. I feel bad. I'll feel bad for a few more generations. You know? Or do you say, well, let us try to do something. You know? We look around our community, we say, we are adults. You know? I could sit here and I could wait for the government to fix it. You know, I could wait for my tribal government to fix it. And you know what? I would still be waiting. That is the reality. I would still be waiting. And I am not a very patient person. You know, and nor do I feel like spending the rest of my life complaining about why they didn't do anything. In the case of my government on my reservation, the tribal council, they all went to jail. 1996, 23 separate convictions each for corruption. You know, so if I was waiting for them to fix it, I would be waiting a long time. Tribal government, tribal council system given to us by the federal government taught us everything we know. You know, my reservation. So we create this project, White Earth Land Recovery Project. Our goal, it may take us 50 years, may take us 100 years, is to seek return of public land holdings as a start. A third of my reservation is held by public agencies, federal, state, and county governments. Tamarack National Wildlife Refuge, you know, huge other areas carved out of my reservation. I think it is a reasonable request. Return of public land holdings within Indian reservations to Indian communities. Reasonable request. Does not involve displacement of a single non-Indian landholder. Involves transferring back of assets which were essentially stolen in the first place. You know, so that's what we seek. It's going to take a long time. Government is easy to take things, reluctant to return. You know, but we will work on it. You know, my community says, you know, first, you know, we have this land for 8,000 years. If it takes another 100 years to get it back, you know, it's okay. We know. It's just like that old, you all know that old Woody Guthrie song that one side says private property, that other side, don't say nothing, that side was meant for you and me, you know? That's how we feel on my reservation, you know? I see that little private property sign, that's okay, nice I got that sign. You know, but that's how we feel. So we seek return of that, and our other piece of work is acquisition based on a willing seller, willing buyer basis from non-Indian landholders. So we acquire parcels of land kind of piece by piece, 1,300 acres so far, mostly maple sugar bush areas, that's maple syruping areas, organic raspberry farms, a lot of cemeteries. Indian cemeteries we buy back because, you know, they drive their skidders over them. You know, they don't have any respect for our old people. So we buy it back, put a little fence up. That's all we do, my community. That's what we do locally. We work on culture, environment to preserve our language, preserve our ecosystem. You know, what is the relationship of this to kind of the overall struggle, the struggle of the free speech movement, these other movements? We are all part of the same struggles. You know, the struggles to make a collective better for our communities, a better for all. Sometimes I wonder, I feel like this society is largely caught up with the struggle over the rights of the individual. It is sometimes easier to secure the rights of the individual rather than the rights of the collective. And that, I believe, has to be a larger struggle, because that is definitely our case. As an individual person in this society, I may have some rights, but as the collective right of Indigenous people, that does not exist in the framework of the United States. It exists only on the terms which the United States would like to acknowledge it. I say that now because, you know, yesterday, I think it was yesterday, a big case went to the Supreme Court for Indian people. It was called the Mille Lacs case. My reservation, just the reservation south of us, is called the Mille Lacs Reservation. Very small reservation, their land all taken. You know, they have a little area, but they had a treaty that said they could hunt and fish anywhere in northern Minnesota, basically. That was upheld by the Federal District Court, Minnesota. And the state of Minnesota, of course, continued to battle it. And it's up in the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court heard it yesterday. You know, and I pray that the Supreme Court will uphold that little community's right. You know, will uphold the law, the treaty, supreme law of the land, the treaty. You know, these rights signed by your government, you know, signed by the American government, these rights between nations, somehow I hope and pray that that will occur. I have to say I'm not so optimistic, you know. people say this and that about the Supreme Court. You know, I know that many decisions against Indian people. You know, the past 43 cases that went up, I think 41 of them were decided against Indian people on the court. You know, that is a very bad record. I was on a panel about a month ago up at Lewis and Clark, and this guy who worked for Slade Gordon. Is that guy, that really conservative guy up in Washington? This attorney was up there, and he said, well, if this, it's true because the Supreme Court said it was true. You know, and I know you understand how offensive I found that statement, you know. But I look at that, you know, and I think it is the same battle, you know. And one of the questions that Indian people have asked is that in the whole history of the Supreme Court, there's never been a single Indian law clerk, even at the court. A bunch of Indian people got arrested about a month ago out there, just asking that one question. You know, what happened? You know, you guys hear all these cases about Indian people, but, you know, never have been Indian people, you know, all these Indian lawyers, no one has ever been allowed even in the folds of the courtroom, you know, in that way. So I worry about that when I think about that. It is reflective, though, of a conflict that exists in this society. You know, which is deep. It is deep. You know, although the state of California, as I understand it, decided that it liked it okay if Indians had casinos, you know, on some level. But that is not, and it's a huge issue in this country. You know, I'm not a gambler. What would I say? You know, I gamble with these little sticks. You ever seen this Indian stick game gambling? That's what I do. That's how I do, you know, and I feel like life's kind of a gamble. That's about how I gamble, you know. So I'm not a casino gambler, but, you know, our communities, we have these casinos, and federal government pretty much says to Indian people, you can have a dump or a casino, you know, and we'll support your rights to sovereignty in that, you know. We think that's good. But you want to regulate your groundwater? You want to exercise jurisdiction? You know? You want to tell non-Indian people what to do within your borders of your reservation? No, you can't do that. But a dump or a casino, yeah, you bet. You know? I mean, I hate to be trite about it. But you look at the tendency of policy, and I would say that that is kind of within the tendency of public policy, you know, which I find indicative of the illness, you know, of the illness in the society. But it is reflected in the relations to Indian people, too. You know, I know that you are all people of, you know, good conscience and good thought, but I also know that a lot of Americans, they feel like they support Indian people, or they support Indian sovereignty so long as Indians are poor. You know? If Indians have a casino, we don't necessarily support Indian sovereignty anymore. Or if Indians are in your face and saying, we want this peace back, you know, we don't feel so comfortable about that. You know, that's the reality. You know, I'm looking at y'all now and you're all listening to me very graciously, but I know that when we asked for the northern half of the Tamarack National Wildlife Refuge back up there in northern Minnesota, some of those environmental groups really opposed it. You know, and I am well aware that there was a very heated battle in the Sierra Club over immigration. Similar battle over Indian issues in the Sierra Club. Sierra Club openly opposed the return of the Tamarack Refuge to our community. Why? You know, why do environmental groups, or why do some groups oppose return of things to Indian people? You know, they said, well, if Indian people have that land, then they'll have sovereignty over it. And we won't have a say. You know, and I said to those people in Sierra Club, I says, you know, I didn't notice you saying anything the past 40 years when they were clear cutting up there. You know, we have a concern when other people, when people of color, you know, when Indian people say that's land we want to take care of, they want to tell us how to take care of it. You know, it's not like we didn't know how. You know? I'm saying this, I know this hurts some of your ears, but this is the free speech, right? You get to say things that hurt people's ears sometimes, that's right? No. I'm obviously saying it because, you know, I talk to you all And I'm hopeful that, you know, you guys will work with your folks on this stuff. You know, I don't know how else to say it, but you got to engage in this discussion about what it means to relinquish the illusion of power. You know, that's what it's about. You know, the idea that, you know, relinquish some of that. You know, we have power over that land and we don't want those other people to have that. You know, get down to what that's about. You know, what fears that's about, what that's about in yourself. Kind of begin to, I mean, I have to say the challenge for the progressive movement in this country, one of the challenges for the progressive movement in this country, one of the challenges for all of us is to deconstruct colonialism in our heads. You know? It is, you know, I'm hopeful about that process. Why? Because at a certain point, I think that everyone figures out who their allies are, you know? And if you can't drink the water, if you can't breathe the air, I mean, all these things, you know? This is not about people of color doing this, you know? This is about people of extreme privilege who made choices that affected all of us. Need to move from a society based on conquest to a society based on survival. Need to move, I believe, from a society that causes so much extinction to a society that considers and actualizes a little better how to live within natural law. You know, after all, you and I are not so big. We are someplace between a mountain and an ant. We are not so big in the big in the picture of all, but yet we have this gift of reason. Remember that it is possible to make change. All of you have influenced and resonated with each other to make change. It is individuals who make change possible. That is our teaching, people of the seventh fire.
Winona LaDuke, in part one of a speech titled Indigenous Vision for the New Millennium. Her speech was recorded and edited for Wings by Amy Pomerlow. A second half hour of this speech is also available from Wings. For more information about Wings, check our website, www.wings.org, or email wings@wings.org. Wings is supported by our station subscribers and with gifts from donors, including the following: the Gaia Foundation, the James R. Doherty Jr. Foundation, the Rachel and Ben Vaughn Foundation, Eleanor and Bert Alper, and Genevieve Vaughn, author of the book Forgiving, A Feminist Criticism of Exchange. Special thanks to Suzette Cullen. Our sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle Is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden, and this is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
It is not a conflict between the left and the right, you know, the communists and the capitalists. It's not. It's between people who live on the land and resonate from the land and industrial society, the predator and the prey.